shut up.
Just shut up.
Crom.
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away. Take it away.
Don't sound as bad on the podcast.
Link it up. Link it up. Happy Wednesday.
Hi, this is Leo, and if I want to know what's happening in Linux, hey, I'm going to listen to the Linux Link Tech Show.
Yeah. The Linux Link Tech Show. That was Leo Laporte, who we have an interview with tonight due to Pat's diligence.
Yes, I pestered him for, 4 or 5 months already. I finally got around to talking to him. It's not going to be a live interview. This is a pre-recorded interview. I spoke to him on Monday, and he was very gracious. We got a good 45-minute-plus interview in, so should be good.
So I don't know. I don't know how the sound is tonight. We'll just go with it. It sounds fine. Oh crap! I left the music on again. I always do that. Why do I always? That's the one thing I always forget.
All
the people who are on the podcast don't hear that because that's only recorded. Oh, that is recorded on the MP.
You're recording the
MP3 even off the.
Let's start.
Don't worry about it. Screw it. Just keep going.
Did you kill the music?
Yeah, I killed the music now. Yeah. I got everything. It's always got my hands full with trying to
get a pint of Heineken.
Yeah, trying to drink the Heineken and control the two different recordings. We'll just, we talked about it before. We'll record the MP3 off the AUG, or I could just do some post-editing.
The AUG always sounds better, in my opinion.
Yeah, well.
Hey, where the hell's Lincoln and Alan?
They're dead. Alan got the AIDS and.
got the SIDS.
Yeah, and then, once he got it, it was only a matter of time before Link. Alan said he had to work late. Link said he has extra amount of work. Just a lazy excuse to sit home in the air conditioner. Well, the good news is we don't have extra laptops.
We got extra beer.
Which won't drag in, take out too much.
More beer.
More power out of here and cause another, take a dump.
We're drinking some fine Dutch ale, some Heineken.
Heineken. And these are what? Heineken pints. Do you buy these in a case or do they
buy
them
loose.
Separately?
They're loose.
How much do they charge you for?
Too much.
Now, this is not a 40. It's almost like a 40.
Hey, what do we look like? Low-classer? Come on.
Hey, 40s are good. You could get a 40 of Bud for $2.50.
Bud shit, man.
Or
that's
a 40
garbage.
Of.
It's piss water.
You could get a 40 of Old E. Colt 45.
Dan, you're going down that road, huh? That's nasty, man.
Hey, you think about it. You get 2 40s for $5, right? You sit down, you drink those, you're good for
goddamn
the rest
drunk.
Of the night. That's it. They're the perfect size for a paper bag to sit on the corner and drink out of.
These are pretty nice, though.
Yeah.
This is like a perfect size if you're like, it's the wintertime and you go to a movie theater and you have like a trench coat or something, you just slip the bottle right into the inside pocket. It's perfect.
Do you go to a movie theater with a trench coat on?
No.
That's all you wear is a trench coat and nothing else.
I don't go to the movies much anymore. It's, I got a little baby at home.
It makes it tough.
Yeah.
Makes it tough. Oh, yeah, Mickey's Big Mouth. Did you ever have Mickey's Big Mouth? You've had Mickey's Big Mouth. You never had Mickey's Big Mouth?
What's that?
It's malt liquor. It's, they come in a bottle that has like a funky top that you take off, but they're a wide top. That's why they call them Mickey's Big Mouth.
So
I think they
it?
Were shaped like little beer barrels, if I'm not mistaken.
Nah, I'm not familiar with that.
But Mickey's, they're kind of cheap.
Kind of like a Mad Dog?
No, but it's malt liquor. It's not
actually beer. The best malt liquor I ever had was, I was in a Thai restaurant, and the Thai beer, Singna, I think it was. It was malt liquor, and it was really good.
What was it?
Singna, I think it was.
Not Sing Tao, which is Chinese.
No, this is Thai.
Or is
Thai
that
beer.
Japanese? Sing Tao Chinese or Japanese? I thought it was Chinese. Ah, well. Too much beer.
Yes. Not enough time.
Dun, dun, dun.
So how are we tonight?
We're not doing too good tonight.
What's the matter?
Look, everybody's not here.
I know. Everyone's freaking missing.
So we have... I got to Skype them in soon. Do I even have Skype running anymore?
Hey, did you hear Scotty? Jimmy Doohan died today.
Yes, unfortunately.
85 years old, man. God bless him.
No more Trek reruns for him.
No. He was suffering from, was it Parkinson's disease? Last few years?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough, man. That's sucks getting old. You get fat, you die.
Yep. It does suck.
Yep.
Well, more power to him and to his family and friends, you know.
That guy was
condolences.
He was a war hero, you know that? World War II.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I enjoyed him, though, in his roles as Scotty. I don't think I really saw him in anything else.
No, nothing else.
He was, I know he did other things, but that's what he was known for.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the original series myself. I think it's still the best one.
I've liked them all. Deep Space Nine, probably the least. I can't say about Voyager because I never really
Voyager
saw
sucked, man.
An episode of Voyager.
It was like the pointy forehead of the week, Alien, and then the reset button. Like they would go through this really traumatic thing where half the ship was destroyed, half the crew was wiped out, and it was all dream.
Yeah, because that always works.
Yeah, they must have done that about 20 times.
I liked Enterprise a lot, the new one.
Yeah, the last season was awesome, man. It got better towards the end. It's a shame.
And then they canceled it.
They pulled the plug on it, man. Meanwhile, the freaking Voyager got 7 freaking seasons of that shit.
Yeah. Well, they got Battlestar Galactica from
there. Well, Ron Moore. Ron Moore used to be one of the main writers on. He did. I think he did some Next Generation. I know he was on Deep Space Nine, and he was also on Voyager. But he kind of got pissed off when he was on Voyager. He didn't like the way it was going, and he bailed on them. But Battlestar Galactica, man, great show. Did you see the season premiere last week?
I have it on TiVo.
Awesome, man.
Do I have a question about sure. that. The doctor, who always sees that blonde chick, is she a figment of his imagination, or is she like some kind of special Cylon? Or well, don't you know?
Well, she's a Cylon. That's a given. That's Baltar, who's the main evil guy. He's definitely different from the original series. The original series, he's...
Wait. Are we talking about the same person? The doctor.
Guy's Baltar, yeah. The doctor. Dr. Baltar.
And he's the guy that was doing the Cylon test.
Yes. He was banging her when he was back on Caprica.
Now, is he a Cylon?
No. Not as far as we know.
But she's a Cylon.
She's a Cylon.
But is she a figment of his imagination?
I don't think so. I think they stuck him something in his brain to you know, so that she can pop into his consciousness whenever she feels like it.
Because I'm coming in on the end of the first season.
Yeah.
So I'm only seeing reruns and stuff. So.
I think she shows up when she wants to.
I don't know.
He's the vice president, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
At the end, towards the end of the season, they elected him vice president.
Go figure, huh?
It's definitely a different character. The original series, the old Baltar character, was kind of like the skulking, evil Benedict Arnold type guy. It was played by John Callis, who was on. He was also one of the Star Trek original Klingons, way back when.
So you know that more than I would.
Yeah, I'm a geek, man. I love sci-fi.
Battlestar Galactica was a little before my time.
I was a kid when it was on. It was a little cheesy, you know, that whole '70s thing.
Mm-hmm.
But for its time, it was okay.
I just haven't seen many episodes or recall many episodes.
There's a few good episodes.
My dad always watched Star Trek, so not too much Battlestar Galactica.
Well, Battlestar Galactica was only on one season.
Was it?
Yeah, and then they came back in 1980, that Battlestar Galactica 1980, where they actually find Earth, and it was just really bad. I don't think it lasted more than like 3-4 episodes. And then
then 10 years later, they had Earth, too. Remember that?
Oh, that sucked. The only cool thing about that show was Clancy Brown. Remember him? The Kurgan from Highlander?
Oh, yeah, he was on
there.
He
was cool, that guy.
Yep, him. And some of the chicks weren't that bad.
It was a lame show, though.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. To me, the most lamest friggin' show was Earth Final Conflict, which was supposedly written by Gene Roddenberry, but the story behind that was his wife friggin' found an old script in the back of his friggin' file cabinet and sold it. Are you familiar with the show I'm talking about?
Earth Final Conflict?
It had these really, like, androgynous aliens.
I never watched it.
It sucked.
Oh, crap, that's right. We're supposed to do Skype tonight. Not Skype, Asterix tonight.
Okay.
Oh, I forgot about that.
For Lincoln Allen?
Yeah.
Are they on the conference room?
Whoop, I think they're in the conference room.
Let's see if it works.
We will.
This is our first This is our first attempt at using asterisk during the show.
I'll fire it up in a minute.
Did you get the volume levels worked out or no?
I have no clue.
We'll wing it, man.
Yeah, we're going to bring that up in just a second. Some stuff we could talk about. It's an interesting thing I learned today.
What'd you learn?
I was working on installing Palm software on a Windows XP machine.
Now, is that Linux-based now?
Not yet.
Soon, though, right?
I believe the next version of Palm is going to be
Linux-based.
Because
they're converting, right? They're getting rid of the old OS.
Yes. The next version. Anyway, in the process of installing it on a laptop using a trackpad, okay, I pulled up the menu. You know how sometimes when you pull up a Windows menu, system under the start menu, it gets kind of sluggish or whatever. So if you're like moving through the menu and you want to go to like, say it was like Office or something to pull down the Office options, it would take a little too long and then you'd move the cursor and you'd either lose the menu or... You know how it gets funky sometimes? It just doesn't keep pace with the mouse?
Mm-hmm.
Well, something had happened where I moved across the startup menu item and ended up like dragging it onto the desktop. So it copied the startup folder or item from the startup menu onto the desktop. All right? I was like, ah, what the heck? I go to delete it. It tells me it cannot be deleted because it's a critical Windows component, the startup.
Don't you love those?
Right. And I'm like, well, what the heck? The startup folder still exists in its original place, still exists on the start menu, but now it got copied to the desktop, and I can't delete it. It won't let me delete it. So I figure, okay, maybe it's read-only for some reason. I right-click on it, uncheck the read-only, go to delete it. So nope, I can't delete it. So it's like, man, this is really weird. All right. So I figure, well, maybe I can trick it by changing the name of it. So I rename it to just like O-O-H-Y or whatever.
Whatever.
Still won't let me delete it, right? So the guy next to me is like, I'm like, look at this. It won't let me delete it. He's like, well, go into safe mode and delete it. All right, I drop down to safe mode. Comes up, will not let me delete this folder off the desktop. So I'm like, okay, I'll drop down into the command prompt, into DOS, and I do a listing of the desktop directory. And I notice that even though in... Windows, the file has changed. When I do a dir command,
still the same.
It's still the same.
Piece of shit.
So I rename it down there through DOS using RAN, and I can delete it after that. Now I tried to use delete tree, but delete tree doesn't exist on Windows anymore, which is weird. I don't know why. So you know, of course, the next thing I'm thinking in my mind is, well, what happens if I create another directory and name it startup on the desktop? So I do that. And I try and delete it, and it says, I can't delete it. It will not let me delete this directory because it's a critical Windows component. I'm like, wow, that's really odd. So I have to go down again to the command line and rename the directory and delete it. I was like, that's really odd. I wonder, you know, if that is across all machines, if there's something funky about this one. So go over to another machine, another Windows XP desktop machine, Service Pack 2. I create a directory on there called Startup on the desktop, and I delete it, no problem. I'm like, wow, it just must be something screwed up with the laptop. So my next thing to test this out was, well, let's see. Maybe something got, you know, quirky when I copied the startup folder off the startup menu. So I copied the startup folder off the startup menu onto the desktop, and I got the same thing. It would not let me delete it. All right? So I went down under the command, into the DOS prompt. I renamed it. And sometimes I found that, you know, you have to go through this process a few times. Rename it, try and delete it, rename it, try and delete it. But before you can, you know, delete it, you have to either through Explorer uncheck the read-only bit or use a trib on the DOS command line to remove the read-only bit. And then you can delete it. So it got really funky. And then any time after that now that I copied the startup folder onto the desktop, any time after that, anytime I create a directory on there called startup, it will not let me delete it.
Huh, interesting.
So it's really weird. And I have an idea as to why this happens. Don't know 100%. But if you look in documents and settings, you know, you have the user accounts in there as like administrator, all users and groups, and then any other users that exist in there. Well, for somehow the startup directory in each one of these users is also linked to the startup directory in users and you know, all users and groups. So I think when you create a new user, whatever mechanism that's involved with linking the startup directory to that user's all users and groups with your own startup directory, somehow it gets kind of quirky that if you would take this startup directory and copy it anywhere else on the system, you'd probably experience the same results. Somehow a link gets created or some kind of association gets created with the all user startup, and it just, you know, gets a little quirky at that point. That's my
Windows
hypothesis.
Fun.
Hypothesis. I haven't tested that second one yet because I don't have any Windows machines here, and that was only at work. But I found that pretty interesting.
You're not including that Windows 98 machine in the corner here.
Yeah, you wish there was a Windows 98 machine in the corner.
Okay, here comes Asterisk.
Not according to Yahoo.
Hey, Alan. Link, what's up?
Hello.
Hey.
Holy crap, they contacted us. Oh.
You should be so lucky. Now, how are you listening to the show and being on Asterix at the same time?
I'm not.
The laptop next to me.
He's got a second machine.
I have the laptop next to me as well.
Ah, Alan's got dual inputs. Outputs.
Dual, yeah. Well, no, I got two machines. So I'm just... I had it playing in the background, so I knew you guys
inputs,
were coming around soon.
Two outputs.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
You guys are missing out on the good beer here. We're drinking Heineken.
Yeah, we heard the Heineken stuff.
Next week...
You guys are a little bit, you guys are a little bit, like, distorted on this end, but...
Maybe you should lower the volume, Dan.
We'll see. If we lower the volume there...
Bring it down a little bit.
It gets lowered everywhere. Hold on. And then we have a problem with it in the recording.
How about now?
You sound fine, Dan. Pat sounds like the microphone is up his ass.
Yeah.
It is.
How about now? A little better?
No.
No?
Yeah, again, your gain is, like, super high.
See, he sounds fine to me.
How about now?
Yeah, that's good there.
Yeah?
That's a little better, yeah.
That's way back, way down.
Now we got to go through all the audio tests again.
Who knows what the level sounds like?
Test will do.
All right. And let's hope that, number one, we don't lose power. What was that? And number two,
need to ask the
listeners hard drive,
how we sound.
They say we sound fine, and that's all that matters.
As long as we sound okay.
And the Asterix server doesn't go wonky again. Like the hard drive keeps bombing.
Is that the problem,
that.
The hard drive?
I think it is, because every couple of days it just starts getting all these... sector errors, and then
we should swap out
the power off and smack the hard drive around a little bit and turn it back on. Yeah, we're eventually got to get down to swap.
I have a drive if you need one we could use.
Yeah.
Good.
Anyway, you know what? I wanted to bring something up before we get to the Leo Laporte interview. But do you guys have anything to add? Anything you'd like to chime in on?
No, because I haven't heard a damn thing you're talking about yet so far.
The only thing that we talked about. Was we did, you know, we talked about Scotty.
Battlestar Galactica.
Scotty dying.
Seven of Nine was the reason that Voyager stayed on so long.
Seven fucking seasons.
Well, Seven of Nine, yeah. We also talked about, if you read my posting to the Lug today, about the Windows desktop foobar with the startup directory incident. You didn't? That's what
I did, yes.
Yes, that's what I talked about briefly. And the next thing I was going to just quickly discuss something about licensing costs. Some interesting stuff I found out today. So if you guys don't have anything, I'll quickly run through that and then...
Discuss away.
Okay. You know, again, this is going more towards Microsoft stuff now, And be interesting just to bring this up, because maybe a lot of listeners don't know about the cost of Microsoft or how it actually works.
How does it actually work?
So what I'm going to talk about just for a couple minutes is I had a very long discussion today, a very informative session with one of our companies we do business with, who's a Microsoft provider. And she explained to me the entire academic licensing options that are available to us and the costs and everything and how they actually work. Now, there is a difference here. If you go by Office or any Microsoft product or pretty much any product out there, software in the software business, there's kind of like three different levels. There's, of course, everybody, like, you know, there's consumers. Well, I should say four. There's consumers, what you buy in the store. Then there's like corporate pricing for large businesses and medium businesses. There's governmental pricing, and then there's educational pricing. So generally speaking, educational pricing, I believe, probably is the cheapest. Yeah. All right, so you get significant discounts for educational pricing, and then maybe government would be next, and then business and enterprise, and of course there's consumer. Well, anyway, just talking about Microsoft Office 2003, okay, looking to make sure we're all compliant with our licensing, trying to figure out what license scheme we need to go with, what's the cost is going to be anyway. All right, so if I just went out and briefly before the show today, went to CDWG and looked at prices for Office Professional 2003, how much it costs. All right, and for academic pricing, it comes to $159.06 per copy. Now, when I talk about these prices here, I'm going to talk about buying for, like, say, 800 copies of or 800
it's
licenses.
It's a lot of software.
Right. For, like, a medium-sized school district, be 800. All right, now, if you were a stupid school district and you went out and bought individual copies of Office at $159 a copy, that's going to run you $127,000.
A lot of money.
And $127,248. Right. That is an awful lot of money. All right, but you're not going to do that because they have different schemes. And, of course, the more you buy, the lower the cost per license. All right, so that is what the school district would pay per copy had they bought it through, like, a retail channel. Now, of course, teachers and students can get it a little cheaper at $138 a copy.
What a bargain.
But that wouldn't apply to the school district. Now, generally speaking, off-the-shelf Office 2003 Pro, full version, costs $467.83.
Wow. That's a lot of money, okay? Man.
Now, if you went out and bought 800 copies of it, that would be $374,264 for 800 copies of Office. But again, you wouldn't do that. Upgrade is $319.23 if you already have a version of Office. Okay, so based upon those figures right there, let's talk about what academic licenses are available to us. And again, I haven't done research into enterprise licensing or government licensing, but I bet you the scheme is kind of the same. Of course, it's going to be cost significantly more than the academic licensing. All right, first academic license that's available to school districts, K-12, is called the Academic Open. And basically what that license is, you have to buy a minimum of 5 units, okay? And after you purchase a minimum of 5 units, then you can purchase more units at a discounted price. I'm not sure exactly
what
that price is.
Now, when you say 5 units, is that 5 licenses?
5 licenses, okay. The licensing scheme is not limited in that case to just Microsoft Office. It's pretty much any of their products. It could be Windows upgrades. It could be Office. It could be Visual Studio, whatever you want to buy. Something like that, the Academic Open License, would be for a small academic center, maybe a private school where they only have a couple, like 25 computers or so, or a preschool where they only have 3 or 4 computers. Essentially what it is if you know, you buy a couple of computers and then you add another one a little later on, it's not going to be as expensive to keep adding Microsoft software as if you went out and bought it retail. Again, I don't have the exact pricing on that because that would not apply to us in any way. The second level is called Academic Select. Now, with the Academic Select, there's a minimum of 250 units that you must purchase. Now, we're talking for Office, which we're looking at. That's a minimum of 250 copies or licenses for Office. All right? Now, this really wouldn't apply to an individual school district unless you are very large. Because, again, what happens is you end up being put into different price tiers. So, depending on the amount of units that you are going to subscribe to, it lowers the cost. The higher the amount of units, you get into a different level, it's a different cost. Now, this would be ideal for a consortium, a bunch of school districts going together through a single entity to purchase multiple copies of multiple units of Microsoft products. We actually have a consortium that we can go through for this, the IU13. Now, our price per copy, per license of Office through the IU13 because they have a huge number of school districts, and it might even be all the school districts in Pennsylvania might be able to go
so
through
this. So it's like one large pool that they buy.
Right, it's one large pool. Comes out to be $51.80 per license, okay? Which then comes out, if we bought 800 of those, $41,440. Still, it's, you know, it's a pretty big chunk of money right there. Now, what that gives us, all right, that gives us the capability of purchasing office on their plan, on the Academic Select. Academic Select runs for 3 years. It's a three-year agreement. And what they say in that 3 years, okay, you have a minimum number of units that you must subscribe to be able to pay over that three-year period. And I think, like, each year you have to sell a certain number of units or have a certain number of units that you're subscribing to. What that says is over that three-year period, if you want to buy another copy of Office or more licenses, you are charged the price in that tier level that you're at. So if you bought, if you were at, you had like 15,000 units, and say that was level C, all right, and next year you want to buy 500 more units, you get charged at the level C pricing. If the price goes up by 10%, you still get charged 10% above level C. All right, so it keeps you at that level. Then when the third year comes around, the contract goes away, you renew your contract and start all over again. Okay, so pricing depends on how many units you want to buy. Now, there's an add-on to that, which is called the Software Assurance Program. Now, if you add on the Software Assurance, that means for a few dollars more, usually about $40 to $50 or more, for that three-year period, if any upgrade version of Office comes out, newer version, you get any upgrades, you get any new versions. All right, you don't have to pay any extra. That is approximately $40 more at their price level. So, and that's a three-year agreement.
Unit or what?
Per unit. Per unit. $40 more per unit during the three-year agreement. Okay? So during that three-year agreement, any upgrade that comes out, you get. At the end of the 3 years, it's all done. You either have a choice to renew the contract or you just take the software you have and you're done. That also means during that three-year period with the software assurance, you're under that maintenance program. You get all the updates, upgrades, and everything. At the end of that maintenance program, you can continue to renew or not. If you continue to renew, all right, you can get any upgrades. You sign on for another couple years or however you want to do it. If at any point you let that maintenance agreement lapse after that 3 years, you cannot get on another maintenance agreement. If you don't go with the software assurance and you come to the end of the 3 years of this term and you say, I want to add on another 3 years, but I want to get the software maintenance, you can't get the software maintenance on your existing licenses. All right, you have to purchase the software maintenance or software assurance at that time of purchase of the product. All right, anyway, the cost of buying 800 licenses with the software insurance would be $65,440.
Wow, that's a lot of money, man.
That is a lot of money.
Oh, shit,
but it's half the price of buying it at the full academic retail price.
What a bargain.
$127,000, okay? $65,440. And that's, again, for 3 years. It's a one-time fee. At the end of that 3 years, you get the licenses, unless you want to renew the contract. Now, the third license agreement is called the school agreement. And what this is, what the school agreement is, you license per building. So if you want to license, say, your high school or whatever building, you have to count up every single computer capable of running Office in there. And I don't think that that includes 486s anymore. But any Pentium level machines, any G3s, G4s, anything of that level that is a computer, regardless of whether it's running Windows, Linux, OS 10, or whether or not you're going to run Office on it, counts as a unit. All right, so you get licensed per machine, even if you're not running Windows. If it's capable of running Office,
you have to count it.
You have to count it. Now, again, if you had 800 computers, it's an all-or-nothing thing. You have to count every single one of those. If you elect to do it just by building, say, your high school and middle school and then not your elementary schools, all right, you cannot install any copies of Office off of that license in those buildings at the elementary school. If you want to install one copy of Office at the elementary school, you have to license it under the academic agreement and get in charge for every single computer you have in there.
Now, what about audit agreements?
Now, hold on. Now, you can go out and buy a, you know, a separate copy of Office to use in there, but it cannot be under the existing agreement. It has to be outside. The cost per unit for the school agreement is $20 per year, per unit. You get into either a one-year contract or a three-year contract. So for 3 years at 800 units would be $16,000 a year.
Much cheaper than the other one.
It is, but it comes out to be over the lifetime of this three-year contract, $48,000. So
not that much cheaper.
It's a little more expensive than just buying it through the consortium price Academic Select without the software insurance, but you get software insurance included in the school agreement. So if any product comes out that you have a school agreement with in that time period, you automatically get the upgrades. But there is a catch. All right, here's the catch. When you enter into this agreement, you sign up for a minimum number of units. Okay, so we're talking, let's say we're having 800 units. You must maintain that minimum number or more for the next, for the entire length of your contract. So let's say you have a disaster and lose 200 computers. And then next year...
You still got to pay for it.
Right. You still, next year, you only get 100 computers. So you're running at 700 computers. You still have to pay at the 800 unit price for the next 2 years, even if you don't have 800 units. You have to pay the minimum. Second, if you get in that year from between year one and two, if you get 500 computers in that year, you will not have to pay immediately to get the license Office software on those 500 computers. It would just be added on to the price of next year. So next year, instead of 800 units, you'd be paying for 1,300 units.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's a little benefit right there. You can go with a year contract. That's up to you. But what happens then is at the end of that year, you have three choices. You can renew your contract, which is means creating a new contract. You can buy out the licenses, so you pay the cost. It's probably not the full cost of how much it would be, but it's like a little bit cheaper than buying them full version, but you get like a difference between how much you've already paid and how much it actually cost. Or you can just drop all stuff, all agreements, not pay anything, and remove the software from your machines. So under this agreement, at the end, you don't keep it, all right, unless you pay for it again. If you go with the three-year contract, same rules apply. At the end of the 3 years, you can buy the license. You can re-sign up again for another 3 years or 1 year, however you want to do it. You can buy the licenses, or buy out the licenses, so you can keep them then, and you're done. Or you can drop it, and you have to remove all the software. One of the benefits of going with 3 years is during that 3 years, your price is fixed for the cost of the each unit. So if the price goes up for Office, like say it would go up to $23, your price remains fixed because you have a three-year contract. So that's a benefit of using it like that. Now there's a little bit more, too, for academic licensing. This program allows you to also have a student option, okay? If you want to have your students be able to use Office at home. Now, I don't know the exact cost per unit, but it is an additional cost. And again, just like building licenses, you have to license it for the entire student body in that building. So if you only wanted to have 30 students take it home, you still have to license it for the other 300 or so students that would be in that building. Again, but you only have to do it by building. So it is an additional cost. There used to be an agreement that teachers, if you got an Office license, your teachers would be able to use it at home. That agreement still exists under these requirements. Number one, teacher has to sign a contract that says, I will only use this Office software on my system at home for work purposes.
Is that in blood?
Well, it's a contract. Now, what happens is, say Microsoft decided to audit...
everything in blood.
Right. Say Microsoft decided to audit the school. If they audited the school, they can come into the house because you're using a school license.
Get the fuck out of here, man.
And look at your machine. And if you're caught violating their license, the school's not going to be held responsible. You will be held responsible for
you
that.
You are.
Right. You will be held responsible for that. So, you know, that's the thing. And now, to make matters worse, there's only three ways that you're allowed to install the software on a home computer for a teacher. Number one, we have to make it available for download from our servers. Okay? Who the hell is going to download Office install or do an Office install off of our servers at work?
Give them a disk.
Over the internet. Okay. Number two, they have to bring their home machines in for us to install.
Oh, God.
Okay? Now, that would be an administrative nightmare. Or number three, you can purchase special disks from Microsoft to be able to give to them that they can use. Now, these discs
do they
are sold. I don't know if they self-destruct, but they are sold in bundles of 25. So you have to buy them in bundles of 20. If you have five teachers that want to do this, you have to buy 25 copies. And I don't know what the price is on there, but you give them this copy, they take it home and they install it. Nobody else can use it. Okay? It's only one copy per person.
So the bottom line is they've got you by the balls and they're squeezing.
They do. So ultimately, it is cheaper to go with a school agreement to pay annually. Okay? It comes out to be just a little more, but you get the software just a little more than buying, like, the licensing from a consortium. It's just a little more, but you get the software assurance. Okay? But they lock you in. That's what they do. They lock you in. Now, I emailed this. It took an hour and a half for this lady to explain all this to me because it is kind of complicated. And I had to write all this up. I emailed it to my boss. And at the end of the email, I said, now, on another note, we can install OpenOffice on every single computer in the district, give it to every single teacher, and give it to the students to take home, and they can give it to their friends, and we can upgrade forever at $0. You know, it's just something to think about. $0. $0.
For free.
Right, for free. It wouldn't cost us
1 cent.
Right. So, I mean,
but you have to associate some kind of price with it, otherwise the boss thinks you're, you know, bullshitting her or something right there.
Well, she's familiar with OpenOffice now because it's been three years that I've been espousing how wonderful this damn thing is. And I do training
sessions.
Tell
her it'll cost you $14 per 100 copies for the CDs, right?
Right. So, you know, that's just something. If people who don't know the pricing, now, again, at a school agreement, 800 units we're talking about, at $20 a piece, $16,000 a year, that is significantly cheaper than what businesses are going to pay.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so think about that. That's still a heck of a lot of money. Now, just so you understand where I'm coming from here, our budget used to be approximately $300,000 a year. All right? So, you know, paying for office through a software agreement without buying a school agreement with, like, through the consortium, $65,000 for that year is what? A fifth of our budget right there. We can get a bunch of computers for that. That's a huge chunk of money.
That's a lot of money.
Or, you know, $16,000 a year. And, again, I'm saying I'm using a generous number of 800. And I know we have more than 800 computers. But it gets pretty damn expensive. A lot of money. Thought people might like to know that. That's what I learned today.
Shitload of money.
You know what? And I've been watching and looking in a bunch of different web pages lately talking about Linux being used in the school districts. In fact, there were some news stories about it today about, who was it? I can't even remember now, but it's another school or set of schools or education in a different country. I can't remember where it was. But they're gonna switch to using Linux on their machines, you know, Linux and OpenOffice, for that same, you know, purpose, because it saves so much money on their education budget.
So just one of the South American countries, because they're big on that down there.
I can't even remember what it was.
Brazil or someplace like that, I think it is.
Look it up. No, Brazil has already switched over.
Yeah. But you know what? Before you get all too happy, we got to play this interview with Leo Laporte. Is it Leo Laporte?
Laporte!
So are you guys ready to hear this interview? You
go
there?
For it.
Pat, you want to talk it up a little bit?
Nah, it's Lilo Pat from the Twitcast and the screensavers. Let's hear it.
Anybody else want to talk it up before I... No? Okay,
fire it
fine.
Up. Fire it up.
Let's see if this will actually play while Lilo you guys are still
from
on.
The Twitcast and screensavers. Let's hear it.
Can you hear that, Link?
Nope.
No.
Hi, this is...
You know what I'll do? I'm going to play it. No, I can't do that from here either. Well, you guys, can you guys get on the stream and listen to it? Because I only have one machine here. All right?
I will indeed, and then you can Skype us in afterwards when you get Leo on.
Leo's not coming on.
I haven't heard back from him.
Oh, okay.
All right, so we're just going to play this, and we'll talk to you in a little bit.
All
we'll
right,
get back,
and then I'll
get back on.
Yep, I'll jump on a conference afterwards.
All right. Here we go.
Link, you still there?
Hi, this is Pat from the Linux and Tech Show, and we're talking to Leah LaPorte from the TwitCast, formerly of the Screensavers, and
Call for Help.
Hello, currently on Call for Help Canada, on Tech TV in Canada. Leah, thanks for coming on. This is a real, real big honor to talk to you.
My pleasure. So hard to start. Sorry, it was so hard to get a hold of me.
I know. We've been talking on and off since February, I believe.
This schedule is my crazy
schedule. I know. You're a really busy guy, and I really do appreciate the fact that you're taking time out of your hectic schedule to come on.
My pleasure.
So I guess we'll start the interview off. Leo, I was looking over your website and your blog, and I noticed that you were a Chinese history major in college. How did you get into broadcasting, and have you always had an interest in computers?
Well, it was a choice of getting a real skill or being a professor of Chinese, or maybe working in the foreign department. So I didn't, and you know, I love Chinese. It was kind of a kooky major. I just, you know, you had to pick something, right? So kind of almost a history major. It was a Chinese history major.
But do you speak Chinese?
I did. You had to learn it for the major. The major was called Chinese Studies, and it was kind of a multidisciplinary. So you had to learn the language, which meant daily 2-hour intensive classes in Chinese, and then learn history. And that's why I dropped out. It's like it's my junior year. I was working at the campus radio station, and I thought, you know, I don't really want to be a Chinese professor. I fell in love with radio. Is what happened, really.
So you did college radio?
Yeah, I did college radio. And to answer your second part of your question, there were no computers at that time. This was 1977 you know, there were no personal computers. So, in fact, I remember my station manager was a real geek, Eric Schwartz, who later went on to run Mountain Computing, which was a big hard drive company. I think it's still in the Silicon Valley. But he was a real geek and was building a computer. We all mocked him. I think it was probably the kit that started the whole revolution off that was in the popular electronics or popular science.
Was it the Altair?
Yeah, the Altair. But I don't know. But I'm thinking now, in retrospect, that's probably what he was building. But we all mocked him. We didn't. At the time, you know, if you wanted to be into computers, you would go into the computer lab with your stack of cards. You know, and it was so I had no interest in that at the time.
Now, what were some of your early interests in computers and programming? And what were some of the platforms and languages that you worked on?
I started getting interested in computers when they became personal. And the first computer I really got to play with was a CPM computer that I talked my boss into buying at the radio station in San Jose. This was probably 79. It was a Northstar Advantage. And Northstar was famous for its BASIC. It had a really good BASIC and a vector graphic in the BASIC. So that was the first, and I started programming that right away. We had a. I talked him into buying, man, that thing must have been, I don't know how much he spent on that. I talked him into buying a hard drive. One of the early hard drives was 5 megabytes, not gigabytes, kids, megabytes. But it was big enough to put a compiler, a C compiler on there. It was Whitesmith C. The problem with it was you had to bootstrap the compiler. I didn't really understand it. It came with a very rudimentary C compiler, and then you bootstrapped it up by compiling all the libraries and building a much more elaborate compiler. And it took me, but it was a great learning experience. And I ended up doing most of the stuff in BASIC, the Northstar BASIC. And then you know, I was into kind of games. I would go to Chuck E. Cheese all the time and play, you know, Battlezone. And so I got an Atari 2600, which was, you know, the gaming box at the time. And I was quickly dissatisfied, so I bought an Atari 400 computer. And that was the first computer I owned personally, and then upgraded to the 800 and did write a lot of stuff in Atari BASIC. And just kind of fell in love with it. And
great.
So AIM got me started, but it quickly changed to programming. I loved programming.
Great learning tool. The old Atari 400, as well as the, you know, the Commodore VIC-20 and the Commodore 64.
Yeah, they were inexpensive, and you could do a lot with them. And then, of course, at some point, I made the decision pretty early on, I'm going to have the latest, greatest computer always, whatever it takes. And so I started writing for magazines to support my habit and stuff like that. That was early on.
So you did radio and then you did writing for magazines as well?
It's my profession. Of course, it was just a DJ at the time. It didn't have anything to do with technology. In fact, it wasn't even talk radio. And then I would go home at night and I would never program professionally, just program for fun as a hobbyist. Wrote some shareware or freeware and stuff, but never did it professionally. And then I would, to support my habit, I wrote for Atari magazines in the early days and eventually wrote for Byte and InfoWorld and a few other magazines. So I had a hobby, which was technology, and I had a profession, which was radio. Didn't combine them for another 10 or so years. It wasn't until about 1990 or 91 that I started doing computer talk radio.
Now, I became a viewer when you were on ZDTV and then eventually became Tech TV. Mm-hmm. The thing that made you different than anyone that I know of is you have a genuine sense of enthusiasm for technology. Does technology really excite you as much as it seems?
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody goes through phases. I joke and say, damn, I wish I'd become a gardening show. We all go through phases where technology is frustrating and boring. But I have to say, I don't think I could have picked a better subject to focus on. It's mentally challenging. It never is boring. There's always something new. And for somebody who's a journalist, it's great because nobody dies. I don't cover helicopter crashes or terrorist bombings. I would have a hard time doing those things. I used to do news talk radio, and it was very difficult for me because it was hard for me not to empathize with the victims of these things. And I could never be the kind of guy who would stick a mic into the face of parents whose kids had just died and said, how does it feel? And so I wasn't cut out for real journalism.
Basically what you're saying, Leo, is you're not a prick.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I don't know if that's the right word. But, you know, when I do talk news talk radio, there's always just a lot of pressure to be confrontational and controversial and stir the pot. And it would give me stomach aches. I'd go home and I'd be unhappy. So, when I did general talk radio, I wanted to do culture interviews and find out about stuff and learn about stuff. You know, I did kind of, it didn't do very well. It was like public radio, you know, and the ratings weren't very good. So I was gracefully let go and put in, you know, Rush Limbaugh came along in 1990, and I was one of the guys who was displaced by him. And they said, well, you know, we don't want to fire you. We like you. You're good. Why don't you do the weekend specialty shows? So I did. I'm not kidding. For a while, I was doing 9 hours on Saturday and 9 hours on Sunday. I would be the host with an expert in gardening, home improvement, money, food, wine. And one of the deals I made was, I'll do it, but can I do a computer show? Because this guy John Dvorak, I've had on the show a few times as an interview, he's really great, and they let me. They were very skeptical. This was 1990, remember? It was Windows 3.0, but they let me do, in return for doing 9 hours of other stuff, they let me do 2 hours once a weekend with John C. Dvorak, and that was really when it began for me.
Currently, what are some of the things that interest you in the world of technology? What's exciting to you right now?
The thing that's most exciting to me is what we're doing right now, which is user-created content. The real promise to me of personal computers and digital technology is the empowerment of individuals. It started on the web, where anybody could have a website that would be every bit as good and as every bit as visible as U.S. Steel and the New York Times. And now that was a huge step. A.J. Liebling used to say the power of the press belongs to the guy who owns the presses. Well, we all own presses. And now, look what's happening. Podcasting is taking off, and people, who were never had a voice before now have a voice. And to me, that is really what this is all about. That's the real promise of this.
What do you think radio is going? Do you think it's dead? I mean, where's it going?
Maybe it's dead. I mean, what's great is this is a renaissance. This is a rebirth of radio. I'm a radio guy, and I have never been so excited in my life. We thought, you know, radio is the 1930s, the 1940s. The golden days of radio were in 1940s when people were gathered around the radio listening. Ever since, it's been kind of dying off. This is revitalizing the whole medium. I mean, it's not broadcast radio, but all of a sudden, people who love audio, as I do, you know, I really believe in the value of audio. I don't think you need, sometimes working in television is frustrating because it's very picture-oriented. And if you can't figure out what picture to put with your TV talk, you know, your conversation, then the TV people say, that's not good TV, it's not visual. Well, that means ideas, abstractions, don't do well on TV, but they do great on radio. And radio is just, for me, it's such a natural medium. It is my medium, and so I couldn't be happier. I'm just thrilled.
Well, this leads right into my next question, which you've kind of answered already. What is your favorite media? I mean, you've worked in almost all of them. You've done TV. you've done radio. You've written books.
I've done more writing than most people, both magazines, weekly columns. I've written, I don't know how many books. I have 4 books out this year, 5 coming out next year. And I hate it every step of the way. It is the most painful process because it's solitary, it's painstaking, it's slow, it's too much typing. TV, I love. I love performance media. I think in my heart of hearts, I'm an actor. I'm a performer. That's what, if you ask me what I love and what I wanted to do as a kid was act. And so I love TV because it does allow me to perform with not just my voice but my body, and I really enjoy that a lot. So if I had to pick a medium, I guess it'd probably be TV, but I do have difficulty with the fact that TV is very expensive to produce and requires, a big company behind you still, and as a result, there's huge pressure to conform, to fit their models of what makes good television. And I don't do what they think makes good television. Now, I happen to think it makes pretty damn good television, but and I know a lot of geeks who feel the same way, but mainstream media goes, huh? So radio and TV definitely are my favorite media for different reasons. Radio is very intimate. With radio, you're having a conversation one-on-one with somebody, like as we're having right now, Patrick. And that, I think, is incredible, too. I love them both.
Now, you currently do a weekly show on KFI in LA on technology. Mm-hmm. From what I've heard, it seems to be mostly newbie-type questions, Windows-related type stuff.
Unfortunately. I mean, basically, my philosophy has always been, Patrick, not to guide the direction of the show, but to let the... When you're doing talk radio, one of the real values of talk radio is the listeners will tell you what they want to know. So it behooves you're doing a call-in talk show, behooves you to listen to what they want to know and answer those questions. So that's why I do if people wanted to know about Linux, and sometimes they do, I'd be talking about it. I'll talk about what they want to talk about, not what I want to talk about. So that's what talk radio is about.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that a lot of people want to know what your thoughts are. I'm sure you know what I'm going to answer right now. Basically, what I'm interested in is the whole thing with the Comcast takeover of Tech TV. From somebody on the outside looking in, it seems like you were one of the first people to jump ship.
I jumped ship. They threw me off the ship.
So that was where my question was going. Did you see the writing on the wall and decided to get the heck out of there? Or
no,
you
no,
forced
no.
out?
They let me go. I would have probably stayed, and I'm glad they let me go. My timing was just serendipitous. My contract had run out. It ran out April 1st, and I was willing to renew. I was very anxious to renew. I wanted to stay with the channel. We had spent 6 years building this channel. Not only did I believe in it, it was my baby. It was my heart and soul and blood, sweat, and tears, and I wasn't going to abandon it.
Yeah, I mean, you did call for help as well as, the screensavers.
I did 2 hours a day live for 6 years on that channel, and I was on the air on that channel for more than a third of the broadcast day for all 6 years because they repeated those shows. That was my baby. I worked very hard. I worked 10 years for that company to build the channel in the first place, and then 6 years on the air with it. So I wasn't about to abandon it. I did have to abandon the screensavers, but they abandoned me. They didn't sign a contract with me for the longest time, and I had to find work. I knew that I saw the writing on the wall in the sense that I knew they were getting rid of me.
Right.
So I got the job at KFI, and at that point I was working 7 days a week. So I said, look, I can't work 7 days a week. But this was before Comcast bought it. They agreed. They said, well, pick a show, and that was a tough one. But the screensavers didn't need me as much as Call for Help. Call for Help really was a one-man show. The screensavers had Patrick and had Kevin and plenty of people. So I picked Call for Help. I said, "That's without me, that show doesn't succeed, so I'm going to do Call for Help." And also I felt like the people who watched Call for Help needed me more than the people who watched the screensaver. So I chose Call for Help. It was a tough choice. And as it turned out, it was probably...
You were the lucky ones.
Because keeping my job, it was the wrong choice because that was the show that as soon as Comcast came in, they canceled.
Yeah.
Ironically, the number 2 rated show on the network consistently, before X-Play started to take off, it was the number 1 show on the network for a long time. Neck and neck, we'd swing back and forth with the screensavers. But given the lousy time slot, I think if they'd put it in primetime, it really would have been the number 1 show all along. And they decided that they didn't want it. So, and at that point, they had nothing for me. I remember going in and meeting with Vinny Longobardo, who is the program manager there, who's since left, by the way. I went into him, and he said, well, we don't have anything for you. You were canceling your show. You're not on the screensavers.
It seems all they were interested in doing was getting the user base that people would subscribe to Tech TV onto the Comcast.
But I'll tell you what happened. I mean, Tech TV, really, if you want to pick a villain in this scenario, it's Paul Allen. Paul Allen bought Tech TV, spent a lot of money. He lost a lot of money on this. Kind of ran. This is, by the way, what he does. He buys a company, micromanages it into the ground, and sells it at a loss. So that's exactly what he did with us. He bought it, micromanaged us, forced us to do this 9.5-hour news block called Tech Live. After about 3 weeks of Tech Live, Paul wanted to pull the plug. They said, you can't. You just hired 100, 200 people. You can't pull the plug. We just built a $1 million set. Finally, they pulled the plug after 9 months, fired a lot of the hundreds of people, and then Paul Allen immediately started shopping the network. He sold it for probably one-half what it was worth. The kind of going in the cable business, the going rate for subscribers, we had 44 million subscribers. The going rate for subscribers is about $150 a head. So if you're a channel with 40 million subscribers, you're worth about $600 million. He sold us for $300 million. So Comcast said, hey, this is a deal.
It's a bargain for them. Well, on to bigger and better things.
I hate to rehash it because, you know, it's done.
Yeah, people want to know that one. I'm curious.
Blame them, and it's sad. And, there's the story in a nutshell from my perspective.
Now, one of the things that you're doing is you're doing Call for Help in Canada. How are you approached to get onto that show? And what can listeners do to get that show broadcast in the United States?
Good question. They literally came to me within 2 weeks of the cancellation of that show. They said, it's our biggest show in Canada. We air it over and over again. They love it. The Canadian FCC, the CRTC, requires that we up our Canadian content. If you were to come to Canada and produce the show, it would qualify as Canadian content. Is there any way we could talk you into doing that? Now, I had already posted on my blog saying I'd go anywhere to do Call for Help. I'll go to Sandusky, Ohio. So I really couldn't say no. I'd already promised that whatever it took, I'd get that show back on the air. So they made me a very good offer. I went up there. I love Toronto. I love the people. They gave me complete control of the show, which was a very important part of the deal for me. So I was really happy to go up there. And I just signed another year deal with them. By the way, I can announce that. That just happened. So we'll be doing Call for Help through August of 2006. We've tried very hard to get it on in the United States. We have a full-time person selling. She sold it to Australia, where the show is a huge hit. Every market the show's been in, it's been a huge hit. But broadcast executives take a look at it, and they say, well, God, it's cheesy. They got this fat guy talking about technology. Nobody wants to see that. We can't imagine anybody wanting it. And now it's produced in Canada, which is a further kiss of death to U.S. networks. Because there's very, you know, chauvinistic. Well, the only people who can do TV are, you know, us. We are the only people who know how to do TV. So I don't, you know, whether we'll get on in the United States or not, I don't know. I haven't given up. I'm very hopeful. The success of Twit, I have to say the success of Twit's influencing people because they see 250,000 people listening to this every week. And I'm, you know, it's opening some eyes. They're going, well, my gosh, maybe there is a market for this. So Kevin and I and Patrick, we're all just plugging away, doing our thing, making the best content we know how. It doesn't really matter in the long run if network television in the United States gets it, because we'll do it if they don't.
Exactly. Who cares what they think?
You know, it's in many ways, I'm glad to have control over it. That's more important to me than the thing is, I want people to see it. Currently, there are BitTorrents of Call for Help, and people can download it. Those are, you know, not non-sanctioned BitTorrents. I've kind of talked to Rogers, the managing partner on it, and they're open to the idea of making it available on the Internet, but they don't want to. We'd make a lot more selling it to a U.S. network than we would trying to do a subscription thing on the net. So they're not going to give up on the U.S. networks yet. If it becomes clear that nothing's going to happen there, then I think it's very likely that we'll produce it for the Internet.
Now, you're currently doing the Twit podcast with the Earl Tech TV crew. How did it come about and why?
Well, we just missed working together, to be honest with you. The thing I love most about working at Tech TV, and I hope everybody gets this experience sometime, if you're in the tech field, there is no better thing to do than to get together with colleagues in the field and shoot the breeze. I would go down to the labs and just hang out with these guys, or just we'd sit over coffee, and you'd learn so much about what's going on right now. And that's what every, there's this exchange going on of, well, what's new? What's different? How did you do that? What's the best distribution of Linux? What's going on with Linus? What's going on with Microsoft? And this constant feedback loop of information was really important to me. And it was it's the thing I regret in many ways the most about, miss the most about Tech TV, is that I don't get to do that anymore. So we've always stayed in touch, but at Macworld Expo in January, because they all went down to L.A., so we all got together at a brew pub, and I had brought a tape recorder, and we recorded, and we just talked, and it felt so good. And then I put it on the net, and everybody just went crazy. And I thought at the time, gosh, if we could just figure out a way to produce this, the problem is they're in L.A., they were spread out all over. Then I, a few months later, I started playing with Skype. In fact, you started using it on the radio show. You can even, if you want, listen to the genesis of this, because there was one particular radio show where I put on three Skype calls, and it blew my mind. The quality was so good. I thought, wait a minute. We could do a radio show this way with Kevin in L.A., Patrick in San Francisco, me in Sonoma County. We could actually do it. And that's when the light bulb went on for me, and that was April or May. And I think the very next weekend we tried one, and we haven't stopped. So you can hear the episode zero, which is the one we did at Macworld. That's on the site, and then we're now in our 14th episode. We've been doing it for 14 weeks now. And what blows us all away, it was totally unexpected, is the response.
I enjoyed it. I listen to it every week.
I'm stunned, because frankly, it's just us sitting around talking about stuff we care about. We're really kind of doing it for ourselves, to be honest with you.
That's how we feel about our show. It's just a bunch of friends, people who have a common interest, want to get together, talk about things that are interesting to them, and sharing our ideas with other people and hearing what they have to say about it.
It's like I said, it's the part of Tech TV I miss the most, which is just sitting around and shooting the breeze with other people who are really wired and finding out what they're talking about. And so that's all we're doing, and we're just taping our conversation and putting it up on the net. but I think other people have the same craving for this kind of information, and so clearly there's that interest. And our goal now I'm, now that I've seen the interest, I want to kind of up the ante. People have been very generous with their donations, and I'm thrilled about that. And what it's going to let us do is do the show in front of a live audience, and really create something that is right now it's exactly what it sounds like, exactly what it is, which is a bunch of guys shooting the breeze on Skype. But what I want to do is make it a show again.
Now, Kevin and Yoshi, they do some video shows over the internet. They do System and From the Shadows. Are you guys looking to do video as well?
Kevin very much wants to, and I think will do a video version if we do. See, now that we're all what's happened? Twit is kind of weird. It's almost as if it was meant to be. Every step of the way, without any effort on any of our parts, stuff has just clicked into place. It's like somebody is. The puppet master is moving the strings here. It's like it has to be. There's this sense of... So what we're going to do next is do it in... everybody's moving back to San Francisco, just kind of coincidentally. So now we can do it together in person. And what we're going to do... Kevin's got these great cameras. So I think we're going to start in September once Kevin gets up here, sit around, record the podcast, but also video it, and we'll offer a video version. Kevin, very excited about doing that. And then I'm also, I'm working on a internet television show as well. I mean, it's clear that IPTV is about to happen, and so we're all very interested in doing that. Everybody I know now has either a podcast or a TV show, and I'm going to start an Apple, a Macintosh-oriented show with my buddy Alex Lindsay in September, Pixel Core, and that'll be a weekly half-hour probably.
Now your last point segues into my next question. It seems you're mostly a Mac guy. Why do you think the Mac is better?
I'm not mostly a Mac guy. For instance, for our record, so we're putting together the remote record unit, I got a mixer and all that stuff, and I needed a small portable computer. I was going to use my laptop, and the Mac laptop just doesn't have enough oomph to do this. So I just bought a Shuttle PC with a FX64 in it and a Raptor hard drive, for purposes of recording the show. So I believe in using the right tool at the right time. I do have to say on the radio show more and more, I'm not alone in this. Walt Mossberg with the Wall Street Journal and a lot of other people are saying, if you are a home user, you should not buy Windows. It's just not safe. So I am very clear about that. I think that if you're buying a computer for the home and you're not going to become a security expert, you should buy a Mac. The other reason, I mean, from a geek point of view, I like Unix, and the fact that BSD is underneath this gorgeous shell, I mean, I spend as much time on the Mac in the command line as I do in the GUI.
Yeah, that's cool. What do you think of the weaknesses of Windows? I mean, obviously security is the one that sticks out in everybody's mind.
You know, Windows is, you know, it's funny. For a while, I was very anti-Mac. Apple went through a stage with OS 7, 8, and 9 where it was antiquated. Its memory management was antiquated. It was just it was an out-of-date operating system, and they couldn't update it. Windows is now in that position. I use the I'm not a bigot one way or the other. In fact, I think Apple, frankly, is going to be as bad a monopolist if they were ever had the market share with Microsoft. They'd be worse. Look what they're doing with podcasts and iTunes. I mean, I think that I don't think Apple is somehow benign and wonderful and magic. I use the best tool for the job, and Windows is hideously insecure. And the other problem with Windows, and it's the problem bred by success. Microsoft can't do what Apple continually does, which is cut the cord, leave the old version behind, and start over again. And Microsoft has too many installed users. That's what they need to do with Longhorn, but they can't. You see them trying and failing. And I think the company's doomed if they cannot do that. They have to say, sorry, we're going to leave behind every one of you 50 million users who refuse to upgrade because Windows is antiquated and needs to be revised. The security model is fundamentally flawed and cannot be fixed.
They need to do a rewrite of the operating system is what they need to do.
They need to start from scratch.
Yep, absolutely.
And they made a bad decision. In fact, when they made this decision almost 10 years ago, I was very vocal about it. They made a very bad decision with their security model in Windows. It was clear as a flawed decision, the certificate security model, and it's biting them now. Took them a while. It's biting them, and they can't do anything about it. You know, Unix has a good security model. You can't, without a root password, you can't modify the system. Period.
Yep.
On Windows, everybody's root.
Yeah.
Period. Is that a good model? No.
It's a fundamental flaw.
It's a fundamental flaw, and it can't be changed. They tried to change it with XP, and it failed. They'll try to change it with Longhorn, but watch, every time they try to make a major upgrade to Longhorn, they have to pull it out.
Now, changing up gears, Leo, what are your feelings on digital rights management? You know, iTunes and other applications that have it embedded in part of the operating system, part of the application and the file system?
You know, I don't want to be too dogmatic about it. I understand why content creators want to protect their right to make money. There's a pendulum that swings back and forth between the rights of users and the rights of content creators. Right now, the pendulum has swung way too far in the direction of content creators, mostly because they have the money and they can influence Congress and they can convince them to pass appallingly bad copyright legislation and so forth. And I think there's a very real public interest, the commons, as Larry Lessig talks about it, the creative commons, the commons of ideas, is critical to innovation, to growth. Walt Disney couldn't have written Snow White, Cinderella, without those public domain fairy tales. But then, of course, the Disney company pulls up the ladder and says, yeah, well, we could do it, but you can't. We're not putting in. Nothing has gone into the public domain since Mickey Mouse's birthday in 1927 because the Disney company continues to go to Congress and says, sorry, we don't want copy. We don't want Mickey ever to be public domain. So anything from 1927 on is not in the public domain. That's very closely tied to rights management because, of course, they need now some technological way to make sure people don't steal it. Digital rights management fails, will always fail, will always be hacked. It only impedes legitimate, honest users. Dishonest users have never been slowed down by DRM. Only people who are honest. So that's kind of a fundamental flaw. You're punishing your actual customers, and you're failing to protect your stuff against pirates, period. So it doesn't work. On the other hand, I understand why people want to get paid for their creations. I create a lot of content. I think what we're seeing is a real change in the philosophy of content creators, and it's an important change. Google is a really good example. Create something great. Open it up. Let people modify it, play with it. You'll find a way to make money on it. Give it away and believe that you will make money, and you do. And, you know, that's why, you know, if I could, I would give away all my books, but, of course, my publisher wouldn't let me. I'm really proud of Cory Doctorow because he has the clout and he has a publisher who believes in him. He does have a Creative Commons license on his books, and it hasn't hurt the sales at all. It's only helped the sales. TWIT is Creative Commons licensed. We give it away. Anybody can do anything they want with it non-commercially. I think, that's if I had a choice, that's how I would license everything I do. And I think that's appropriate. You know, KFI lets me, and I can't believe this, they're great. They let me take my radio show, cut out the commercials, the revenue-making portion of the show, snip it out, and a week after the show's aired, give it away. And has it hurt the show? No.
Not at all.
It's grown the show. I have an international audience for the show now.
People listen over the internet from all around the world, you know?
Exactly. It's helped the show. And I think content creators are going to slowly come around to the realization that the tighter you hold on to your stuff, the less money you make. The more you're encouraging people to become pirates, to figure out ways to crack it. Let go. Let go. You will make a living.
I think what the problem is the movie studios and the record companies, they're living in the old world. They haven't come to grips with what, you know, the current day and age, what technology can do for you, for the artists, for the, you know, for media content delivery.
Well, remember, their business model is based on the blockbuster, the billion-dollar picture. And the problem is, in this new world, you may not have those kinds of budgets. You may not have the multi-platinum artist anymore. Those multi-platinum artists only succeed because 1,000 other musicians never get heard. When you have a situation where everybody who creates music has an equal voice, the dollars people spend on music are going to be spread much thinner. But I would far prefer seeing 1,000 musicians make a living.
Absolutely.
Than one musician make a billion. And I think that's what's going to happen. Now, if you're the guy making the billion, that doesn't look
good. You're nervous, yeah.
That doesn't look good.
Yeah.
But if you're the guy who's starving, I'm constantly amazed by how many talented, wonderful musicians there are out there who have never been signed, because the success of the record industry depends on scarcity.
The other thing is, you know, the record companies, they have an artist. Something is wrong with a system where you have an artist selling 2-3 million copies of an album, and they're losing money, you know.
No, I think it's so sad. I mean, there's so many artists who are ripped off.
You know,
it's tragic.
Why does a CD still cost $15? It cost $15 20 years ago.
Well, remember, you know, put yourself in that position. If you're in a position and you've been able to set up a system where you're raking in the dough.
Yep, keep it going.
It's kind of hard to say, oh, you know, people aren't that altruistic. Oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't make so much money. It's kind of hard to let go of that.
Sure.
I don't blame them. But guess what? Times are changing, whether they want to or not.
Exactly. I guess we should talk about Linux, since this is a Linux show.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Linux, you know, or Linux on PPC architecture?
I am. You know, I because BSD is on Mac, I'm not so inclined to try Yellow Dog. Although a lot of people rave over PPC Linux and say, you know, you're crazy, use OS X. But I like having a commercial operating system and BSD. I think BSD, you know, I'll be honest with you, BSD, in my opinion, is the best Unix out there. So I'm very happy with it. I'm very happy to be running BSD. And as I said, I spend most of the time in the command line. I think any operating system that comes with Perl, Python, Bash Shell, Rebel, and GCC is a good operating system.
Definitely.
I love Linux, and I love Mac.
And there's some great applications, Apache.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, the open source movement is a really good example of how the world could be. It's a mind blower. If people really realize what has happened, the incredible growth and innovation coming from people who are just given it away. We are so fortunate. I mean, there wouldn't be an internet. There wouldn't be Linux. There wouldn't be any of this. All the innovation's happening in open source right now. All of it.
Have you had a chance to try any of the Nubish style distros like Mepis or Linspire, Mandriva, Ubuntu?
I'm not a fan of Linspire only because Michael Robertson really kind of, Michael has changed his tune a little bit, and I think he's no longer trying to co-opt the Linux market for his own personal uses. But so Linspire has left a bad taste in my mouth, and I have not come back to it. Mepis is great. I still like SUSE. There are some really great distros out there. The last one I installed is Debian, and I'm probably a Debian you know, going to stay with Debian. But that's because I know what I'm doing. I still don't recommend it for a newbie. Although I have to say, it's really, the latest Debian distro is pretty easy to install.
Yeah, it's much easier. That goes into my next question. I was going to ask you, have you done a Linux install recently? I mean, not for nothing, it is easier than Windows. Believe it or not, installing Slackware is easier than Windows. And that's a fact, because I've done Windows installs, and I've done Slackware installs. Yeah. I've done Debian. It's easier. You can have a Linux install done in half an hour. A Windows install...
Slackware is the first distro I ever installed years and years ago. And it was murder.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's gotten so much easier. Even, as you said, even Slackware. I've been very happy with Debian. I'm setting up Asterisk, and they recommend Debian. And I was a SUSE guy for a long time.
Have you checked out Asterisk at home? We're currently on our show. You know, we've been using Skype to do our interviews, and it works okay if we do a Skype-to-Skype call like we're doing now. But when you do a Skype out to a regular landline,
yeah,
it's very problematic. Yeah. It could be decent or it could be horrible. Yeah. So we've set up an Asterisk server, and we're in the process of rolling it out.
Are you happy with it?
So far, we haven't rolled it out and used it in production yet, but we've done a lot of testing with it, and it seems pretty good so far. We're using Broad Voice as the provider, and the quality is much better, you know, calling out to a regular landline.
I was going to use Skype Asterisk at home, and then my buddies at Asterisk said, you know, for the flexibility that you want, things you want to do, you'd probably be better off just doing the full Asterisk, because there's some things you cannot do with at home. At home's great because it does it at whole, but I am sophisticated enough to do a full Asterisk install. So they just sent me one of their interface cards, and I'm going through the process right now. The drawback is, unlike Skype, which has codecs that sound really good, like this one, you're only going to get 8 kilohertz codecs on Asterisk. But apparently there's some in beta, some higher quality codecs. I think we would use it. I'm more interested in using it just kind of as a phone system than for the radio show.
That's what we're going to do. I mean, the biggest limitation is bandwidth when you get down to it. Now Skype, it's supposedly you're carrying bandwidth for other people that are on the network. That's what I've heard.
Well, it's supposed to be a peer-to-peer. I don't know what that means. I mean, if you and I are having a conversation, all that really matters is that I have enough pipe to get my voice out to you, and enough, by the way, CPU to get my voice out to you in real time, and vice versa.
And the quality's decent.
Yeah, so the fact that it's a peer-to-peer really doesn't help us. It only helps Skype. It helps the company so they don't have to have massive servers.
Well, whereas an Asterisk box, you know, it's all you. It's all your bandwidth. It's all your servers.
I have a pretty good DSL connection. I'm about 2 blocks from the CO, and I have about 5 megabits down and about 768 up. So I have enough to do decent VoIP. So, you know, we'll see. I'm playing with Asterisk more to learn about it than anything else.
It's exciting stuff.
Conference up in Toronto and had a great time talking to Mark Spencer, and I was very impressed. It's a really good example of a successful open source project. It's just really neat. So I have the hardware, and I just got back from Europe, so I haven't had a chance to install it, but I'm going to do that this week probably.
We'll have to talk in the future about it and share experiences.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting how I hadn't heard about Asterisk until I met Mark, and then all of a sudden everybody's talking about it. It's one of those things that is... its time has come.
It's the next Apache.
I think so. I think so. And I think they've modeled themselves on Apache, and I think they've done a very good job of it.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think that Linux needs to do to increase its desktop user base?
Well, they're getting there. I mean, the problem with Linux is there is no there, right? There's no locus. There's no one guy saying, okay. I mean, there's Linus, there's Alan Cox, but there's really no one guy saying, okay, here's where Linux is going. You hit the nail on the head. It has to be, it is not yet a desktop OS, and I wish it were, because I would.
I think it is, though. I think it is.
It is for geeks. Here's a couple of issues. The install has gotten much better, I agree. The problem is installing new software and dependencies and so forth. And there are solutions, but there's no. And Lynn Spire was, you know, he had a good idea. He realized. I mean, that's Michael realized. Look, this is the problem: is installing software, and he has a pretty good system. Apt-get is great. I'm a big fan of it. I think we're within millimeters, but it's still hard for me to say to my mom, install Linux and use it.
I disagree with you on that, Leo.
We're there?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the guys on the show, we've installed Linux on our parents' machines, and you know, we used to get phones.
You've installed it on their machine.
But you know what? Windows installs are harder than Linux installs. That's the reality. The reality.
People remember, nobody installs Windows.
Exactly. They buy the machine and it's on there already.
Right. So, and, you know, this is what Linspire was all about, is, buy, you know, go to Walmart.
Get a machine.
Buy a machine with Linux. It's ready to go. And if you need software, pay $40 a year or whatever it was, and you can have more software. I think it was the right idea. Gosh, we're close. Part of the things that hurt Linux are that there's so many distros. It's kind of, there's no single voice.
It's a little out of control in some respects.
And I don't think it's a bad thing. For geeks, there's nothing wrong with Linux. There's not, everything is perfect. It's wonderful. It's, the issue is the moms of the world. And I sure would love to come on the radio show, KFI, and say, don't buy Windows, buy Linux. Or get Windows off your system and get Linux on it. And more, I think within the year, we'll be doing that. Right now, I'm telling people, just get a Mac. And it's, you know, what I'd really love to do is say, and by the way, the live CD distros are really helping this.
And OpEx is nice.
What I'd love to do is say to people, oh, no problem. You know, go to CheapBytes for $5, buy this disk, you know, super duper easy to use Linux disk, put it in, and wipe out Windows, and you'll never look back. It's, you know, it's not fit and fit. What's missing right now, I think, is fit and finish. It's the little
polish.
Bits of polish that people expect from a computer. And, you know, we're so close.
Because the applications seem to be there, I mean, for the most part.
We've made huge progress. I think OpenOffice is now stable enough to recommend. The GIMP isn't easy to use, but it's sure a lot cheaper than Photoshop.
And it's very robust.
If you add the Photoshop plugin to it, so it looks like Photoshop. What's the name of that? I can't remember, but it's a great little Photoshop plugin. What is it called? GIMP Shop. GIMP Shop, that's it. You know, it's pretty good.
It is good.
But, you know, there's just different classes of users out there. And remember, I deal with the very most basic users, and I don't know if it's ready for them yet. I may be wrong.
I think it is.
I'd be thrilled if it is. I'd love to be able to say, just dump Microsoft and put Linux in your box.
We've spoken to Kevin Carboni, who's now the CEO of Linspire, and he said that his target audience was the AOL of Linux, the mom-and-pop type people.
When I start getting Linux disks, Linspire disks in the mail, then I'll know. you know, it's interesting. Even just this weekend, for the first time ever, I had two calls in a row saying, I don't want to put in Windows on the Internet. Is it possible for me to run Linux and get on the net and then run Windows for everything else?
Sure.
And I told them OpEx. I said, get a live CD. Well, I have a link to a list of live CDs.
Or do a dual boot.
Or dual boot, although, you know, right there is where your mom and dad are getting left.
Yeah, you don't want to messing with, you know, the hard drive partitions.
Mom, let me tell you about Grub. No, that's not going to happen.
Grub is actually nice.
Yeah, well, I know it is for you and me. You know, this is the hard thing, Patrick, for us as geeks to realize is there is this vast gulf.
I know.
What we know and are willing to do and what normal people are willing to do.
It seems that you have zealots in all camps. I mean, one of the criticisms of Linux in general is that the zealots that are entrenched in Linux, they tend to mock people coming in for the first time. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. You know, I join my local log to help people that have no idea what the heck they're doing, to help them learn so they can learn and teach somebody else doing the same thing.
It's always been a problem in computers that people who are in the priesthood want to preserve their power and their knowledge, and they tend to talk down at the newbies.
And it shouldn't be like that.
I think that's changing. I think that there are more and more people like you, Patrick, who are saying, no, we want, this is a big tent. We want everybody. I hope so.
I hope so, too. I have one more question for you. What in the future would you like to do that you haven't done already?
Boy, that's a good question. You know, I am such a lucky guy. I am getting to do my heart's desire every day. In fact, my only problem now is too many choices, too many great things that I want to do them all, and I don't have enough time. I'm very grateful, Patrick. I don't think there is anything that I haven't done that I want to do. I'm doing exactly what I want to do, and I couldn't be happier about it.
Leo, keep up the good fight. We love what you're doing.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You know what was interesting there? That Pat said he joined a lug to help educate people. I have not seen you at a lug meeting in years.
That's not true. I gave a presentation a couple months ago.
You did? Where was I?
You were there.
Oh, yeah, you did it on Myth TV.
That's right.
I have not seen you at a lug meeting prior to that for years. Nah, but you know what? There's more to the lug meeting than that. There's also mailing lists.
Not for nothing, man. Most of the people that go to the lug meetings are pretty experienced.
Yeah.
Antalio, Leilu was a very cool guy, man. He sent me an email today. He has an update. It sounds like Call for Help will be on G4 in the United States. And so it sounds like they're just working out the details, but it is an eventuality. So that's good news. Any other thoughts before we get cut off by BinRev, or has it happened already?
I don't know. I never brought up the BinRev website. Hold on. I don't know what the official time is. But in the meantime...
We're about to get cut off.
We don't. I don't know if we actually get cut off or not.
Leo was a very cool guy, man. He sounds like he's willing to come on again later on. And maybe we could speak to Kevin Rose in the future as well. We're going to check in with Alan and Link. Hello, Alan and Link.
Somebody's
hey,
on
we're
here.
Yeah, we're here.
We're here and we're all queer.
We're here. We're waiting on you guys.
Dan has a strange fascination with the butts, man. What's up with that, Dan?
I don't know. The butts.
Excellent interview, by the way, Pat.
Thank you. Good job.
Thanks.
Yeah, you've now got the job for doing it for all the new ones now.
You know what? Hold on a second. Unfortunately, we have to cut off the BinRev channel right now. So you're all welcome to come over to the Linux Link Tech Show.
We could still keep talking for a few more minutes.
And or download the podcast, but I think there's going to be some more commentary. But we got the main gist of what we need.
Yeah, BinRev, bye-bye. Good night, BinRev.
So sorry about that for BinRev listeners. We'll give a couple of minutes for you to move over to. They're not going to hear me anyhow. We're already cut off.
Yeah,
what am I talking
for?
We're cut off. Oh, right. Shaka.
I think you were cut off like 3 minutes ago.
Something like that. So we're off BinRev. Go ahead, you... fuckers, say whatever you want to say. Oh, now you're silent.
Blah, blah, blah. Silent before. Words.
No, Pat did a great... You know what? It seems that one-on-one interviews seem to work out a lot better than four-on-one.
Well, it worked out okay because I'm familiar with Leo, you know? I know Leo's work, so...
How familiar are you? You have brought up the butt
before.
Oh, by
the way, I looked up that school district that's changing over to Linux, and it's New Zealand is changing their schools to Linux.
There was also one in the United States somewhere. I don't know if it was Wisconsin. Was it Linux Journal a few months back? There was an article about a school district converting to Linux.
Yeah, there's a couple of school districts that have made the news about it. There was one in California, too. And I'm sure there's a whole lot more that are using it. I mean, I've been a year ago I was at a... some kind of function that was with the gifted programs, and no, 2 years ago actually, and they were actually using OpenOffice there. So I know it's come a lot further than where it was then. I mean, it's penetrating.
It's getting there. It's getting there slowly.
Penetrating. It is
saturating.
So yeah, it's definitely making some inroads.
It seems a lot of the school districts are going the Linux Terminal Server Project route of it.
That is a popular project.
We should talk to those guys. I actually made contact with them. They seemed they were interested in coming on, so maybe we should talk to them soon.
Did you guys, Alan Link, have any comments to that?
No, I thought it was a really good interview.
Look, there's a pause, and then they talk over top.
The interview was awesome.
Thank you.
Anything else to add?
Well, because we have a little bit of a lag here, you know?
Excuses.
It's not as bad as Skype out.
We're lagging.
It's not as bad as Skype out, though.
Wow.
No, actually, I'm hearing you quite clearly over here.
Oh, so Link is bullshitting then.
Actually, hear me. No, Link was getting a little delay when we were talking.
He just barrels right over top of Alan.
But at least with Asterix now, we can talk over each other and it sounds okay.
There you go.
That's one of the cool things about it. Where Skype, you know, one person cuts off the other.
Now, I'm pretty sure your wankers probably read my blog, speaking of Alan or Link, and I know Pat has probably read it too. Over the weekend, I did a Windows install, which took me, using a system restore disk.
I feel sorry for you. I had to do that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and this is not from a Windows 9, XP disk. This is from a system restore disk, which means I didn't have to go driver hunt All right.
Supposedly.
Took me 5 hours. And oh, that's quick. Eventually, no, that's what?
That's quick.
That's quick.
For Windows.
Yeah, but all I had
when... 5 hours?
Yes, all I had when I was finished was Windows with the updates and the patches and virus scan software on there. And SpyBot. And I only had SpyBot and all that stuff because I had a CD. I brought a CD with me that had it. So at the end of 5 hours, I basically had Windows.
Are you sure you didn't also have spyware and viruses?
I probably did because I got sick.
I was going to say, I rebuilt my sister's laptop a couple weeks ago on there, and I think within 20 minutes of me getting on there, I literally, by the time I had SpyBot put on there, I found the first little bit of adware that was on there. I fired up Internet Explorer once because I didn't have a CD that had SpyBot on it for me, so that's as much as I used it for was to download Firefox. And within that time, I'd already picked up one bit of spyware in there.
Wasn't there a report recently?
You probably had a lot of it on there.
You know what they were talking about a few months ago about Windows being infected, like, I don't know, was it like half hour? It seems, wasn't there recently an article that said it was like more like 15 minutes now?
Something like that. I didn't have to fire up.
Yeah, 12 minutes.
I didn't fire up any Windows Explorer to go download anything, but I did have to fire it up 6 separate times to run the update. Because it would update, like, I had to update Windows Update 3 times in the entire process.
It's reboot hell.
Fucking reboot every fucking 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I go run Windows Update, it says it has to update Windows Update. It updates Windows Update, pulls down 2 updates, then it says it has to update Windows Update, then it pulls down another 2 updates, and of course, every time you got to reboot. Finally, it gets done, and it says, okay, now it's time to update Windows Update again. I was like, come on, why can't I just have the final Windows Update? You know,
it's ridiculous,
like,
isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
The whole Windows rebooting bullshit?
It is, but I didn't go anywhere but Windows Update, because I didn't run it from Explorer. I ran it out of the control panel. I don't know. I got to the point where after I had all that crap done, it was like 4.5 hours into it, I finally did the SpyBot install and everything. And then you got to sit there and you got to run SpyBot. You got to run through the whole thing. And then I installed Adware. And then you got to run through the whole thing of Adware. And you sit there and it's like, man, you wonder why people just throw their freaking computers away.
Windows sucks. That's plain and simple.
I mean, seriously, think about it.
Yeah, I want to try to find that dumpster too.
Yeah. I mean, really, and it's true. How much do you charge per hour, Link?
Between 25 and 65 an hour.
Now, is that with or without the happy ending?
Happy ending.
No, anyway.
That depends.
Okay. Now, let's say you go at the low end.
With a happy ending. 25 without.
Well, you say you go at the low end. You feel sorry for the customer, so you're going to be Mr. Nice Guy and charge them $25 an hour. All right. Now, to get a machine functional to install Windows, again, you're talking at least probably 2 hours.
Yeah, normally for regular people, I charge 25.
Now is that from, if you were doing a restore disk, you're talking about 2 hours probably to get it up. So
normally it takes me up to 4. It's usually about $50 to $100 it costs.
So $50 to $100 if you know the person. So you know. Most places I hear are charging anywhere from $50 to $100 just to do that per hour.
Yeah, pretty much.
So when you come down to it, for the general user who's not going to be able to do this, you know, would not understand how to do this most of the time because they don't want to take the time to, it would be more cost effective for them to buy a new computer at $400, $500 and to sit there and fix their old one.
Especially when CompUSA has a special $200 for a brand new PC.
Right. It's sickening. And yes, I want to find that dumpster.
Hey, if they want to donate the machine to me, they can go ahead and donate to me. I'll take it. Fire up another server, man. Put Slackware on there.
Matter of fact, I got one over here from one of the
guys. When they get that $300 PC, that $300 PC is way faster than the one that they already have usually, so.
It only takes, you know, another 2 weeks, and then they find out that it's loaded with spyware.
Slow shit, yeah.
That's just...
It's a vicious circle, man.
And you know what's sad about that? Alan, you got cut off. What were you going to say, Alan?
We're talking about throwing out PCs. I've got one over here from one of Carolyn's friends. She wanted me to fix it, and I got it restarted for her, but I told her it has to be, you know, have everything rebooted on it, you know, all new software. I'm waiting for her to give me the disk, and it's been like a month now. And I'm hoping she forgets about it. I'm going to turn it into a Linux box.
put Damn Small on it. Okay. Have you guys tried a Damn Small
Damn
install?
Small is great.
It's awesome.
No, I didn't do an install.
It's really nice, man.
I use a Damn Small Live.
I shoved it on my old... I have this old PC in my office, like my old computer on my desktop. It's like a 233 megahertz system. I installed Damn Small on it, man. It's awesome.
That's what I use. I use Damn Small to get some documents off the computer I was using, restoring this past weekend.
Oh, yeah. I've got it on four machines at work now.
It's nice, right?
But, you know, what's sad is...
It's great.
I sat down to do a Ubuntu install. And now the Ubuntu install, generally speaking, was the first install that ever took me a long time, more than 20 minutes. And that was because after it installs the base package and software, it asks you whether you want to go out and get the upgrades. You know, and I think Debian does that now too. And even with Slackware, if you go out and update, you know, if you install 10 and then go down and get the upgrade packages, you're talking not more than an hour total,
tops.
And, you know, when you're done, you're not just using, like, you don't end up with just an operating system, a chintzy
you got everything.
Text editor, a crappy word processor called WordPad. Is it called WordPad? And then, you know,
Windows
a
Media
shitty
Player.
Outdated window, you know, internet browser. And a virus-catching email client. I mean, you actually have something you could freaking use.
It's got everything, man.
You got Office products. You got graphic manipulators.
Run a server.
Right.
Everything.
It's just, it's atrocious that you spend all that time doing that and have nothing really to show for it. And people accept that. Why, Link? Why?
They're fucking stupid. That's why.
Yep, they're stupid. I agree with Pat.
And, you know, speaking of stupid, and I should save this for next week, but hell, we're already going over time. How about that shit that Tiger pulled by pulling out iMovie and...
iPhoto, iDVD.
iPhoto and... You know,
Hey, keep paying them, man.
I wiped out my system because Panther, from my upgrade from Panther to Tiger, was dog slow, causing problems. Wiped it out. I was so happy with this thing. So, like, man, this is great now. I wiped it out.
You got to give Steve more money, man. That's the deal.
Right. So I go the other day. I have to convert a video, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I could use the iMovie. I really doubt it, but let's just give it a shot. It's not there. I'm like, what the hell happened to iMovie?
What the F, man?
So I pop in the Tiger disk. It's not there either to install. And I go out looking around, and finally, like, you know, I'm talking to the people I work with, and they're like, well, yeah, it should still be there.
$50, right?
No, it's not fair. $79.
$79.
Education price.
So it's normally, what, $100?
I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, actually, I might be wrong. It might be $79.
What a rip, man.
But now you actually have to go out and buy those products that once came free with the operating system. So I just wanted to see off the bat, you know, if I plugged in my digital camera, what would happen? And nothing happens when you plug it in. In the past, it would bring up iMovie imported. Nothing happens
now. Nothing
dead
in the water.
Nothing happens. You can go into import. There's an import application, a digital import or something. You can import, and it'll drop those pictures into your pictures directory, wherever you specify. It's really about, you know, it's not as nice as iPhoto, but once you get the pictures, you can't do anything with them. There's no photo editing capabilities in there. There's nothing. You can look at them in preview, which is a PDF-type viewer, but that's it.
Wow, how generous.
Yeah, and I'm like, man, that really... Here they are, you go to their site, and they're like, oh, man, they're saying Tiger's got, you know, great crap added to it. It's a beautiful thing. And then you go over and you like look at the comparison between Tiger and Jaguar and Panther, and you got all these things, and they never once say, we removed iMovie, we removed iPhoto, we removed iDVD. Maybe iDVD wasn't in there. But we removed
all
this stuff.
They're not going to advertise it. Of course not.
And maybe I should have had a clue because they added iMovie and iPhoto to iLife.
Yep.
Like last year at 04, and I'm like, well, why are they selling this if it comes with
it doesn't.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Hey, man, I was surprised, man. Leo even said that he's not a diehard Mac person. You know, he said that, you know, Apple, when you get down to it, will be probably worse than Microsoft. You know, right now there's a big conversation going around about how iTunes is breaking RSS feeds. People having problems with the RSS feeds in iTunes. The Gilmore Gang guys were talking about this. I didn't listen to the podcast, but I think somebody posted a blog entry about it, how iTunes is screwing things up.
Well, it's because they put their own namespaces on everything.
Is there an Apple box down there? Black Apple box. Give me that. Here we go. Let me see this.
Dan's got the box right here. Let's see what it says.
All right. It came across from Gorkon that said, iMovie was never free, just included with new Macs. And that is not true, because I have the Panther box right here. When I got my G4 PowerBook with Jaguar installed, I bought Panther. It says key features. iMovie 3, iPhoto 2 are the key features on there. So I got iMovie with purchasing Panther. Now, and I'm mistaken about iDVD. Apparently that's not included. Maybe it was included when I got my system, because I have a SuperDrive on here. But Panther came with iMovie and iPhoto, and those are both removed in Tiger. And, again, like I said, there was really no indication that those were removed. Again, I expected those to be included because they were with Panther.
I hope it's you just, didn't pay out of your pocket.
No, I didn't buy it. The school district bought it. I did, though. I did buy, a couple months ago, I did buy iLife 04 because I wanted GarageBand. I didn't want to take an illegal copy from school. I wanted to buy it, so I would have a legal copy. So I did, that's the way it is. But my copy of Panther Box, reading right off the box, is iMovie and iPhoto are included. No longer!
Arr! You gotta pay. Bend over, bitch.
And I'll tell you what, I absolutely hate slot-loading CD-ROM drives. This thing has been a bugger ever since I got it. I mean, I didn't use it that much, so after it got out of warranty and I finally got an iPod, man, I ripped three or four discs, and afterwards I start getting read-write errors on it.
Seriously, huh?
Then I got to shut it down and start up. Like today, it took me like 2 hours to install iLife.
So all those reports going back when they were comparing Intel chipsets to PVC and chipsets, was that all bullshit, you know, now that they've switched to Intel?
I don't know. I think there's a benefit over PPC over Intel. I think, again, you're talking cost. You're talking availability.
It's going to be interesting how the support plays out in the next couple of years for PPC people, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to open up a niche for people like Yellow Dog, you know, who people who have Apple machines, but the newer versions of the operating system, you know, don't run that well.
Only time will tell. I think we probably better start
wrapping
closing
it up.
This up here.
Are you looking up, Dan?
Huh?
Are you all looking up?
No, not really.
Nah, not really. Yeah.
I got the Heineken burps now.
White Castle?
If only there was. You know what would make a killing around here? We opened up a Sonic.
Hey, there's...
There's no
there's
Sonic.
There's supposed to be a White Castle coming in down in Phillipsburg.
Oh, really?
Oh. Really?
Oh. That's disgusting.
You'd be able to clean out the system real good then.
Awesome.
it tastes good going down, but the next day, man, you're sitting on the toilet for hours.
Oh man, there's one down in by where I work down in Warren, and I swear to God, we stopped there once, man. I barely made it home. Stuff was like
you had a pain,
out.
And you were holding your legs together.
Oh, it was like by the time I hit Phillipsburg, I was like, you know, jamming my foot into the floorboards. I was like, I gotta get home. It was like the run up the stairs to hit the can. Oh man, it was bad. Never again. I've forgotten what that was like, and I don't want to experience it again.
It's liquid Drano for humans.
Oh, it is liquid Drano. That's right.
Clean it right out.
Liquid Drano for humans.
I guess we're going to wrap it up.
It's going in.
What?
Oh, it's good. It's really good going in, but man, coming out.
The closest to White Castle I get these days is you could buy like the frozen ones in them.
That's disgusting, man.
I love them, man. I love the frozen ones. Gross. But you know, you can't get them. You know, it's just like, you know, you can go to Yakko's, or you can
I
try
think
and
they're
make
great.
What Yakko's or White Castle, or either one.
It's colon blow, man.
Both actually.
White Castle's colon blow.
But Sonic, man, if
Sonic
they would
is
only
cool,
open
man.
A Sonic. Where did you go to? There's no Sonic
I've been
within 200 miles.
The last time I was down in Florida, we went to one. And what's really cool.
They're only down south.
I'm originally from Staten Island. In Staten Island, they had A&W root beer. It was like same kind of deal, like a Sonic kind of
right.
place. They have.
There's an A&W place up in Allentown.
Is there still?
On Union Boulevard.
Yeah, there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken / A&W, A&W root beer. Yeah.
Did they come out on roller skates and take your order?
No, but
no, no,
that's
no,
how
no,
that's how A&W.
Downtown, they'd get shot.
That's how A&W used to be.
Well, yeah, but if they did that on Union Boulevard, they'd probably get shot.
Oh, it's not that bad.
I know.
There.
It sounds like fucking Beirut the way you're describing it.
Yeah, well.
Well, all right, guys. I guess we should probably close it up, eh?
Eh?
To our
Canadian friends,
eh?
You hosers.
Eh?
You hang on. I'll tell you a nice little story there. Speaking of, having a run for the border after you eat White Castle, I got a good story. I'll tell you that after.
Jack Daniels and White Castle on an American classic.
Yeah, so.
Alrighty, wrap it up. Episode 93.
That's it. We'll go out with a Leo Laporte promo. Did he send you the promos in AUG format?
No, I did that. He did them live at the very end of the interview, and I just cut them and re-encoded them.
Oh, that's cool. Well, anyway. And, no, I don't want to do that.
Anything else, gentlemen?
Yeah.
Well, I'm Pat.
Good night, everybody.
I'm Pat.
Good night.
Good night.
All.
Good night.
Good
night. Good night, and get out of here.
Good night, John boy.
All right, here we go. We'll close out, but I'll tell you guys how.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and you're listening to the Linux Link Tech Show.
You know I'm going to tap that ass, right?
Oh.
White Castle.
Yeah.
You're making it poo young in the kitchen.
Sushi. You should be ashamed of yourself.
One which I don't think I can take being in the dark.
Well, gave me with a furball.
The Linux Link Tech Show.
You just make sure you let us know when that one hits.
You guys are so weird. We have nothing to compare you to.
I
dare you stand there and criticize. You think I don't know what's going on?
The thing is, we
here?
Can't hear a damn thing they're saying over top of this noise here.
Or do you want the space
and they can't
to
hear
make
the noise.
For you?
Yeah, we can't hear you guys at all.
This part's cool.
Well, the Linux Link Tech Show.